May it please the Court, my name is Christopher D. Ive, and I represent the Commissioner of Highways in this case. This appeal is being brought by the Commissioner of Highways on two assignments of error pertaining to award of the evaluation damages for ported fixtures in a computer board manufacturing plant where the alleged fixtures were untouched by the project and remained in use as before after the taking of this case. The first assignment of error challenged an award due to the fact it was based on false information and misleading argument at trial, and the court not allowing the commissioner to refute these allegations before the trial commissioners. The award in this case is entirely based on a hypothetical closing of the business, which did not happen, and there is no evidence that it's going to happen anytime in the foreseeable future. A fundamental question presented in this assignment of error is whether the court's ruling earlier this year in the case of Ramsey versus Commissioner Highways that relevant, non-prejudicial evidence is admissible equally applies to both sides in the domain cases. In this case, the commissioner believed the trial court, through its granting of Osborne's motion in limine as well as his bench ruling, abused its discretion by disallowing relevant and material evidence that portrayed a false scenario for the jury, which led to an award that was unsupportable in the actual circumstances.
But isn't this calculation supposed to occur at the time of the take?
That's correct.
Well, how do you get over that?
Well, first of all, we do not know when the post-take parking arrangements were even made. We couldn't even explore that. So it's very possible that those parking arrangements were made prior to the taking itself.
You had an agreement on the take. I mean, that happened at a particular date and time, and you agreed to how much. The only thing that was left was the fixtures.
Well, there was a mediation agreement.
What was the take for the agreement that you had? What was that date?
Well, this case followed a very unusual course, one I really, quite frankly, never seen before.
Well, I haven't either, but the question is, what was the date of the take for that which you agreed upon?
The date of take was in 2012 when the certificate of take was filed.
All right, so why isn't that also the date of the take for the fixtures for valuing them?
That would be the take for the fixtures, even if they are, you know, to be considered fixtures. But first of all, even though you're dealing with property here that's not real estate generally, you're dealing with items that have a limited useful life. They are depreciating items, and they are remain in use.
Well, but you, if the valuation is at the time of the take, what difference does it make?
Well, the difference that it makes...
Part of the dilemma is that this case was tried in a certain way. Now, you may wish it had been tried some other way, but it wasn't. It was tried in a certain way. You had a half agreement. You reserved something to be tried later. I just don't see that this is much of a problem. You have a date of the take. You have a date to value. The subsequent use on a temporary basis, it seems to me, is irrelevant. I don't see how you get around all that. And it's a function of how the case was tried. If this was a blank slate, it might be altogether different. But it's not a blank slate.
Well, it's relevant in the fact that what the parties initially, well, at least what they presented at trial, was that the property itself was going to close, or it went further than that. They put before the trial jury that the business had closed and all the property had been sold at liquidated at salvage value. That hadn't happened.
Counsel, the jury was told something that was absolutely factually not true?
That's correct, Your Honor.
What page of the joint appendix can I find that?
That is
why don't you answer during rebuttal? But your statement that the jury was told by counsel something, I presume by counsel, or by a party, something that was factually simply not true. I do want to know where that is in the record, but you can answer it at any time during your 15 minutes. You don't have to answer it.
Well, just to clarify is that basically what the jury was instructed is they had to treat the property as if it had been taken on the day of take and everything liquidated for salvage value.
That was the judge's instruction.
That was the judge's instruction as well as what was argued to the jury.
Is that what you're saying is not true?
What is not true is the fact that the business has continued on as it has before. It's continued on. The damage has been mitigated, but yet they want to reach back and say, but you must treat this property as if it's been taken, and all this property, this business equipment, cars, forklifts, rolling stock, has all been magically was taken and sold at salvage value that day.
See, but it seems to me what you're saying is that a question of the law is a fact. You're arguing about the judge's instruction. That's a question of law.
Well, it's a question of law, but also just what was presented to the jury. In the Ramsey case, Justice Millett asked the question, what's the harm in allowing the jury to know the circumstances, what the evidence should be? The fact is that this property of this nature...
Can I interrupt you for a minute?
Yes.
Let's say, for the sake of argument, that your first point's a good point, that the very calculation at the time it takes necessarily presupposes a forecast of the future, and the forecast here being that there will be a salvage and a liquidation sale. Assume that for the sake of argument, and it's obviously relevant for mitigation purposes. And nobody knows at the moment of the take whether they're going to salvage it or use it or whatever. It's an assumption about the future. The problem here, though, is there was a jury instruction, and it instructed the jury on this point, contrary to your view. And as I read your brief and your Simon of Error, you're challenging the exclusion of evidence, which under the assumed arguendo point you just discussed would be a good one. But you didn't challenge the jury instruction. And ordinarily, we don't reach out and expand the assignments of error beyond the point raised. Do you see what I'm worried about?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. The jury instruction F, directly related to the prior rulings of the court. I don't really think they can be that separated, because it certainly encompassed the earlier ruling of the court.
I agree with you completely. His in limine motion was clear, and the instruction incorporated it, but there's no objection, there's no challenge to the instruction. In other words, in perfect theory, even if you won your evidentiary point, the instruction said what it said.
Well, certainly jury instruction F would not exist without the prior ruling of the court.
Agreed.
And I think it is dependent upon the prior ruling of the court, which has been challenged. So I believe the assignment of error does, it may not specifically name instruction F, however, in the actual heading, but certainly it is so related, I don't think it can really be separated into a separate, to the point where it's not being challenged.
Right, but my point is, F is not a standard model jury instruction. It's a theory of the case in jury instructions, their theory of the case on valuation, which, as you point out, arguably presupposes a future event post-take. But it was an unchallenged instruction on appeal, and whether you got the evidence in or not is going to be dwarfed by that point for appellate purposes.
Well, I respectfully disagree with the fact it's not being challenged. Yes, we did not do a separate assignment of error on it, but the assignment of error, number one, covers instruction F. Instruction F is, very much gone into in the argument on the assignment of error, and I just don't believe you can separate instruction F from the prior ruling of the court in granting the motion in limine, because they were one and the same rulings that essentially that the post-take use of the property as well as the parking arrangements, being excluded from being presented to the jury.
Let me ask one follow-up. At any point in the proffer, did the proffer ever tell the trial judge, look, this is a foreseeable future situation. This is not a temporary thing. The accommodation they've made over these additional parking spaces is going to last for the foreseeable future. The whole factual predicate behind the assertion of liquidation value is just plain wrong. I mean, that would be a far stronger proffer than what was given.
What was presented in the proffer was the fact that post-take parking was arranged, that it has continued on. It was still going on through the time of the trial, which is now 2 years after the fact on the taking. There was certainly no evidence presented that it was temporary in nature. Also presented during different points of the proffer was the fact that new equipment has been brought into the plant since the you know, since the data take, which certainly evidenced that the fact that the parking arrangements were not going to be a very short term. But again, the whole argument when you get to whether or not the parking arrangements are temporary or not, really goes to the mistake that the error that the court made in disallowing this testimony, because if it was a short duration, then maybe damages are appropriate. Long duration, we don't know. No one knows. The jury doesn't know. This very relevant material evidence that's being kept from the jury so they can make a proper determination of the damages that would be appropriate in this case.
Well, in the WAMCO case, we said the measure of damages to the residue remains the difference in value before and immediately after the taking, less any enhancement from the taking. It's the present actual value of the land with all its adaptations to general and special uses, and not its prospective or speculative or possible value based upon future expenditures and improvements.
Right. And
but why isn't that? I mean, you agreed that you were going to settle part of it. The VDOT and the property owner actually agreed that the building was going to have to be demolished. Now, the fact that there might have been something that happened thereafter that would be speculative as to its future seems foreclosed by our case in WAMCO. But having said that, you agreed that you were only going to deal with fixtures. They were going to be valued. The value is not its prospective or speculative value. It's the value immediately after the taking. Why is it that the end of this case?
The reason it's not end of the case is because, first of all, in the rule about how you value property on day to take does allow consideration of future events as well. That is in the rule.
But does it allow the acquisition of a property interest from a third party who is not who is a stranger to the condemnation? That's also WAMCO, and that's you've really got to get around that.
Of course, WAMCO was actually based on a claim for adjustment expenses, and that is what really was not allowed in the case of WAMCO. In WAMCO, there was a claim by the landowner that he was going to have to incur all these additional costs to acquire this additional land from a third party, which was speculative and quite frankly remote. In this case, this is something we're not talking about anything speculative or remote. Nothing was done there was nothing speculative about this. It was already done.
How long is that lease for those parking places? How long is he going to get to use it?
That we don't know.
It's speculative.
It's
speculative, right?
It's speculative, but at the same time, the facts of the circumstances show that with new equipment being brought into the business, that obviously they're not moving anytime real soon. This business is continuing normal without missing a beat.
Isn't that the precise reason for the rule? We're just not going to consider things like that, because you can't answer my question of how long he's going to have those parking spaces. Because it's speculative.
Well, it's impossible to answer that question because the motion in limine kept us from ever being able to investigate that and being brought out for the jury. Your question actually strengthens our position, the fact that we could not get this information for the jury. I mean, if it had been a month-to-month lease...
Well, the reason why you can't is because it's speculative in nature. That's why. Even if it's a month-to-month lease, I mean, a year lease... Now, if it was a fee simple, that'd be interesting. But everybody agrees it's a lease. How long are those spaces going to be available? How long can he operate that property? I mean, our rule makes it pretty clear. It's the immediately after the taking is the date of valuation, and you don't consider things that are speculative.
But the question, well, first of all, it's only speculative in the sense of term, not the fact that it was done, because it already had been done. It was a fait accompli. And the fact is, if without the motion limiting, that could have been brought out, for the jury or at least for the court to make a proper determination whether or not it was speculative, how long it would last.
Which party has the burden of persuasion on the calculation of damages at the time of the take?
The landowner does.
So at the time of the take, the landowner had a burden by a preponderance, am I right? To show that the liquidation salvage value was the only value that could be squeezed out of these fixtures.
That's correct. But
so if if that liquidation value turned on a two-month lease of parking spots or a 100-year lease of parking spots, the speculative nature would be on the claimant, not the defendant.
Well, the other aspect of it is, you know, should this business relocate and these businesses be relocated, then that would mitigate the damages as well. I mean, these damages are only going to be realized if they are liquidated.
You've answered
and sold
it. Thank you very much.
Your time has expired.
Thank you
very much.
Good morning. I'm Steve Emmert, along with Ben Perdue. I represent the landowners in this eminent domain appeal. Because I emphatically refuse to gild lilies, I will truncate what I have to say because you've already recognized a number of the premises that I would have raised. In this case, the commissioner thinks that he made a mistake when he agreed upon the status of the building and is asking to undo that. That's the only way you can get any relief here, by saying that the building wasn't really a total loss.
Suppose for the sake of argument there had been no mediated settlement, there had been no assumption behind the settlement that there would be a complete closing of the plant. Suppose that for the sake of argument.
Okay.
And we were going to a full trial. The burden of proof would be on your client to establish the deduction from the gross residual value to come up with a net residual value of the fixtures. And therefore, in a minute, you can correct me if I'm wrong, and therefore the burden of persuasion would be on your client to demonstrate that the only residual value of this fixture was pure salvage. Nothing else couldn't be used, not going to be used. We have to throw it out on the liquidation market and get next to nothing.
I want to think that through in the context of the Nichols on eminent domain quote that we have on page 10 of our brief that says that the burden of proof to prove mitigation is on the condemnor. We have the burden to establish that there is...
Well, I'm not talking about mitigation.
Well, okay, then in that case, we do have the burden to show what's the value of the fixtures, for example.
Right.
And if they have a salvage value, you have to back that out, which was done...
Had only a salvage value.
Correct.
But salvage value presupposes a fact, which is not present at the moment to take, which is we're going to salvage it. So if the claimant is not presenting evidence that they're actually going to liquidate the fixtures... then the liquidation valuation is not even itself admissible because there's no factual predicate for it.
Under those circumstances, there would have to have been an evidentiary challenge to it at the time it was offered. And I'm not aware of any such evidentiary challenge. There was no objection to it based upon the fact that they haven't adequately demonstrated.
But I'm not really getting after the evidentiary points. I'm just trying to think of the logic. I'm struggling with your first argument, which is this somehow their conceptual argument is inconsistent logically with the time to take valuation. Of course time to take is the test. But when you're dealing with residual value, you have to hypothesize a future event, i.e., in this case, plant closure and liquidation of the fixtures. That's a future event. And the burden of proof to eliminate speculative evidence is not on the VDOT, it's on you. So on that larger point, whether or not we ever get to it, given the procedural issues in the case, I don't know, but how would you help me understand your point of view from that construct?
The burden is on us to establish that there has been damage. In this case, it would be damage to fixtures, but I'll leave aside that distinction for the moment. We have to show what damage there is to the residue parcel. So the first element to that was the parcel no longer has adequate parking for the zoning ordinance, and so therefore the building has to come down. We would have to prove that. That wasn't challenged. That was actually admitted by them in the original certification of what the value was. The next thing we have to prove is what's the value of what was what's the value of what was damaged in this? And since under the case law that goes back at least to the Danville Holding case, fixtures are part of the real estate, we had the burden to show what the value of the real estate, including the fixtures.
I'm in full agreement up to this point.
Okay. At that point, then, we had to show what's the value of those fixtures in place, but because the condemnor wasn't taking the fixtures away, we had to account for the liquidation value of them. That's why we had to back out that cost. And our expert did that.
But that is a hypothesized post-take assumption that we're going to have to liquidate, and that's why our valuation is total actual value less liquidation credit equals compensatory damages value.
I don't think that it is looking at a future value since you have to look at what the value is.
No, it's value based upon a future foreseeable consequence, which is a liquidation.
I'm not sure if I know ultimately the answer to your question, but there's one other thing I ought to point out, and that's that they have not assigned error. Not only did they not object to this evidence coming in a trial, they haven't assigned error to its admission during the trial. So I don't think the court can reach it.
Counsel, I've got a question, but I want to begin with an observation that there's a real irony here. The irony is that I'll begin with the maxim that bad cases make bad law. Why is this a bad case? It's a bad case because the commissioner and the landowner spent a considerable period of time agreeing with each other and trying to resolve this matter in a non-adversarial fashion. And when it couldn't entirely be resolved, the commissioner's rights may have been foreclosed. But we have a legal tension here, and help me figure out how to ease that tension. The tension is between WAMCO and Bradshaw. I read WAMCO that that post-take damages, particularly or perhaps exclusively when a third party or a non-party is involved, are remote and speculative.
It
comes right out of the case.
I agree.
Bradshaw says, you got to mitigate your damages. I'm trying to figure out the path through those two cases, and particularly in the context of a quick take. If you didn't have a quick take, you would have a prolonged period of negotiation, and then you would file your complaint with the take happening at some point towards the end of the process, and you could have full discovery pre-take. When you've got the quick take statute, you don't really get any discovery pre-take. You don't have to use it. Obviously, the commissioner never is required to use quick take. But how do we resolve the WAMCO Bradshaw tension in a quick take case?
The easiest distinction, I won't say even distinction, the easiest answer to your question is that the mitigation that was made, that the court noted was quite feasible in the Bradshaw case, was on site. In WAMCO, the party had to buy land from elsewhere, had to acquire land for a right-of-way, whereas in Bradshaw, all they had to do was move the service bay to the other side of the parcel, the other side of the service.
So does WAMCO always trump Bradshaw? In other words, are you never required to go outside of your current bundle of sticks? Are you never required to acquire a different interest from a different party in order to mitigate your damages?
That part I agree with. I do think that there is no requirement whatsoever.
So there is no tension.
You
apply WAMCO first, you apply Bradshaw second to the extent that you're able to do so.
You can apply Bradshaw if it's possible to mitigate on site. I agree with that.
Yeah. The difference is control.
Right, because you can't control
the Bradshaw case, it's in the control of the person who's establishing the value itself. In WAMCO, it's not in their control.
Just like WAMCO, we didn't have the right to condemn any land elsewhere. If we did, maybe we would have a different case.
So is control the fulcrum?
Probably so, because in this case, if the landowner has the ability to end the damages on his own property, which he controls, then I've got a much tougher road to hoe.
But that's not our case. It's not forcing a mitigation deduction on a claimant's damage recovery based upon the duty to mitigate. The landowner allegedly did mitigate, and at least for 2 years did mitigate. So the issue before us is not do we require it and reduce the damage award for the failure of doing it. For 2 years there was mitigation, and the question is should the commissioners have a right to know, well, this is what's been happening. From the time of the take, there was an assumption made. 2 years later, the assumption has proven to be untrue. Who knows what tomorrow brings? And now the question is, does VDOT or does your client have the burden of eliminating that speculation about who knows what tomorrow may bring?
The cases and the treatise that we've cited indicate that it is the commissioner's burden to show any limitation on the mitigation. And in addition, just like the cases that we cited on pages 14 and 15 from other jurisdictions, particularly the Colorado one on page 14.
Can I interrupt one more time? I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
I'm with you with that. The
okay.
Duty to mitigate. In other words, a court saying, look, you should have gone out and did something. You didn't do it. That burden is clearly on the condemnor. But here is the calculation of damages with a built-in factual assumption, which is we're going to be liquidating this stuff. That burden is on the claimant to deal with the facts that are actually in place as opposed to what might be in place.
Right. And since we have to value it at the time of the take rather than at the time of the trial, which is effectively what he's asking you to do, then the calculation of what the use of the property would have been 2 years into the future or 10 years into the future is irrelevant, and it is, as the Chief Justice pointed out, necessarily speculative.
But at the time of the take, you're making an assumption, which is we're going to close the place down. It's an assumption. It's not been closed down at the time of the take. You're necessarily making a future prognostication to calculate a debit to a damage recovery.
And the parties agreed upon that. This is not merely a point that we're contending something and they're disagreeing with it. The parties reached a settlement agreement and actually consummated that agreement. They carried it out. And now the commissioner says, well, actually, I want to unagree on something that I have previously agreed upon, which is the building comes down.
But in all fairness, they didn't agree to that ratio with respect to the fixtures. They made a good faith settlement. Y'all made a good faith settlement. It seems a little bit awkward to hoist them up on that petard when they were relatively generous with the way they approached the quick take.
They fashioned the petard. What they said was, in this case, the building has to come down, and what's going to happen with the fixtures is a different matter. Well, if the building comes down, it's an elementary question what happens to the fixtures. They're taken too. They're damaged too in the same way. And in that context, this take, this level of damages, this award, and this trial make eminent sense, given the way the case was tried. In this context, I want to review briefly before I sit down the many legal principles, some in the eminent domain context and some not, that you have to undo in order to rule in favor of the commissioner. Condemnation principles include the idea that property is valued as of the date of take, not later, including such as at the date of trial. That's never been the case. If you have to undo the holdings that evidence of off-site improvements and of subsequent purchases of more land are irrelevant and inadmissible, that ownership isn't tried in just compensation hearings. It's a separate 222 hearing. There are appellate principles at issue here, such as the obligation to proffer what the evidence is that you wanted to introduce, not merely, as the commissioner did here, what conclusions you wanted the fact finder to reach. That's all they did. You also have to eliminate the requirement that you brief the errors that you assign. As I pointed out with regard to assignment 2, the only ruling of the trial court that they identify as erroneous in their brief in this court is a ruling that was never made because they never made the motion. There was no motion to strike at the close of the evidence. Finally, there's a basic legal principle that you can't agree to something and then unilaterally back away. These are the fundamental principles of Virginia jurisprudence.
What did they agree to with respect to the fixtures?
They agreed that the building would come down. The building held the fixtures. The fixtures, once the building was
removed. No, I get that. But if you or I were settling a case, and I settled one aspect of the case, and I made some assumptions, you made a good deal, I made a good deal, and things changed, I wouldn't feel bound by that if things changed and we didn't agree to the other topic. That they're feeling pretty much sideswiped by this agreement they made, and they probably won't make any agreements like this in the future if we affirm.
I think that's a fair assumption. But it's not something that governs this case, because they did assume that the building was going to be a total loss, that the site was no longer suitable for
Right, they assumed it. But judicial estoppel doesn't get triggered by assumptions. Gets triggered by affirmative representations to the tribunal.
But that's what they did. In this agreement, they agreed that the building was going to come down, and they also certified them on page 44 of the appendix that the settlement agreement included the cost for the value of the building and the cost of its demolition. That's on the commissioner's letterhead. And so that's an agreement that they've made affirmatively, in addition to the settlement agreement that you've also seen. This is the damage that you have to do in order to rule in favor of the commissioner. These are the things that he wants you to do to our jurisprudence just so he can win this case.
Call the next case.